Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 5, Chapter 15, Episode 99. I mean, come on, how good is that? I know it's a weird time, one day short of 100 episodes, to start feeling proud of myself, but I just can't believe that I've done anything for 99 days in a row. Who knew I had that kind of discipline? I mean, you didn't know me before this podcast, so to you I probably seem like exactly the kind of person that would do 99 podcasts in a row. But I've surprised myself. I'm patting myself on the back. I think I've earned that. Jeez, if this is episode 99, what am I going to do tomorrow? All right, let's read this thing. When returning from his leave, Rostov felt for the first time how close was the bond that united him to Denisov and the whole regiment. On approaching it, Rostov felt as he had done when approaching his home in Moscow. When he saw the first hussar with the unbuttoned uniform of his regiment, when he recognized the red-haired Dmitriev and saw the picket ropes of the roan horses, when Lavrushka gleefully shouted to his master, "The count has come," and Denisov, who had been asleep on his bed, ran all dishevelled out of the mud hut to embrace him, and the officers collected round to greet the new arrival, Rostov experienced the same feeling as when his mother, his father, and his sister had embraced him, and tears of joy choked him so that he could not speak. The regiment was also a home, and as unalterably dear and precious as his parents' house. When he had reported himself to the commander of the regiment, and been reassigned to his former squadron, had been on duty and gone out foraging, when he had again entered into all the little interests of the regiment and felt himself deprived of liberty and bound in one narrow unchanging frame, he experienced the same sense of peace, of moral support, and the same sense of being at home here in his own place, as he had felt under the paternal roof. But here was none of all that turmoil of the world at large where he did not know his right place and took mistaken decisions. Here was no Sonya with whom he ought or ought not to have an explanation. Here was no possibility of going there or not going there. Here there were no 24 hours in the day which could be spent in such a variety of ways. There was not that innumerable crowd of people who, of whom no one was nearer to him or farther from him than another. There were none of those uncertain and undefined money relations with his father, and nothing to recall that terrible loss to Dolokhov. Here in the regiment all was clear and simple. The whole world was divided into two unequal parts, one, our Pavlograd regiment, the other, all the rest, and the rest was of no concern to him. In the regiment everything was definite. Who was lieutenant, who was captain, who was a good fellow, who was a bad one, and most of all, who was a comrade. The canteen keeper gave one credit, one pay came every 4 months, there was nothing to think out or decide. You had only to do nothing that was considered bad in the Pavlograd regiment and, when given an order, to do what was clearly, distinctly and definitely ordered, and all would be well. Having once more entered into the definite conditions of his regimental life, Rostov felt the joy and relief a tired man feels on lying down to rest. Life in the regiment during this campaign was all the pleasanter for him because after his loss to Dolokhov, for which in spite of all his family's efforts to console him he could not forgive himself, he had made up his mind to atone for his fault by serving, not as he had done before, but really well, and by being a perfectly first-rate comrade and officer, in a word, a splendid man altogether, a thing which seemed so difficult out in the world, but so possible in the regiment. After his losses, he had determined to pay back his debt to his parents in 5 years. He received 10,000 rubles a year, but now resolved to take only 2,000 and leave the rest to repay the debt to his parents. Our army, after repeated retreats and advances and battles at Pultusk and Prusilia, was concentrated near Bartenstein. Bit of name murdering there. I'll try again. Battles at Pultusk and Prusich Ilau, and concentrated near Bartenstein. It was awaiting the Emperor's arrival and the beginning of a new campaign. The Pavlograd Regiment, belonging to that part of the army which had served in the 1805 campaign, had been recruiting up to strength in Russia and arrived too late to take part in the first actions of the campaign. It had been neither at Pultusk nor at Prusich Ilau. Prusich Ilau. And when it joined the army in the field in the second half of the campaign, was attached to Platov's division. I'm really sorry about the butchering of this chapter. There's a lot of names in here that are cropping up for the first time. Platov's division was acting independently of the main army. Several times, parts of the Pavlograd regiment had exchanged shots with the enemy, had taken prisoners, and once had even captured Marshal Ordonot's carriages. In April, the Pavlograds were stationed immovably for some weeks near a totally ruined and deserted German village. A thaw had set in. It was muddy and cold. The ice on the river broke, and the roads became impassable. For days, neither provisions for the men nor fodder for the horses had been issued. As no transports could arrive, the men dispersed about the abandoned and deserted villages, searching for potatoes, but found few even of these. Everything had been eaten up, and the inhabitants had all fled. If any remained, they were worse than beggars, and nothing more could be taken from them. Even the soldiers, usually pitiless enough, instead of taking anything from them, often gave them the last of their rations. The Pavlograd regiment had had only two men wounded in action, but had lost nearly half its men from hunger and sickness. In the hospitals, death was so certain that soldiers suffering from fever or the swelling that came from bad food preferred to remain on duty and, hardly able to drag their legs, went to the front rather than to the hospitals. When spring came on, the soldiers found a plant just showing out of the ground that looked like asparagus, which for some reason they called Mashka's sweet root. It was very bitter, but they wandered about the fields seeking it and dug it out with their sabres and ate it, though they were ordered not to do so, as it was a noxious plant. That spring a new disease broke out among the soldiers, a swelling of the arms, legs and face, which the doctors attributed to eating this root. But in spite of all this, the soldiers of Denisov's squadron fed chiefly on Mashka's sweet root, because it was the second week that the last of the biscuits were being doled out at the rate of half a pound a man, and the last potatoes received had sprouted and frozen. The horses also had been fed for a fortnight on straw from the thatched roofs, and had become terribly thin, though still covered with tufts of felty winter hair. Despite this destitution, the soldiers and officers went on living just as usual. Despite their pale, swollen faces and tattered uniforms, the hussars formed line for roll call, kept things in order, groomed their horses, polished their arms, brought in straw from the thatched roofs in place of fodder, and sat down to dine around the cauldrons from which they rose up hungry, joking about their nasty food and their hunger. As usual, in their spare time, they lit bonfires, steamed themselves before them naked, smoked, picked out and baked sprouting rotten potatoes, told and listened to stories of Potemkin's and Suvorov's campaigns, or to legends of Alisha the Sly, or the priest's labourer, Mikolka. The officers, as usual, lived in twos and threes in the roofless, half-ruined houses. The seniors tried to collect straw and potatoes, and in general found food for the men. The younger ones occupied themselves as before, some playing cards. There was plenty of money, though there was no food. Some with more innocent games, such as quoits and skittles. The general trend of the campaign was rarely spoken of, partly because nothing certain was known about it, partly because there was a vague feeling that in the main it was going badly. Rostov lived as before with Denisov, and since their furlough they had become more friendly than ever. Denisov never spoke of Rostov's family, but by the tender friendship his commander showed him, Rostov felt that the older hussar's luckless love for Natasha played a part in strengthening their friendship. Denisov evidently tried to expose Rostov to danger as seldom as possible, and, after an action, greeted his safe return with evident joy. On one of his foraging expeditions in a deserted and ruined village to which he had come in search of provisions, Rostov found a family consisting of an old Pole and his daughter and an infant in arms. They were half-clad, hungry, too weak to get away on foot, and had no means of obtaining a conveyance. Rostov brought them to his quarters, placed them in his own lodging, and kept them for some weeks while the old man was recovering. One of his comrades, talking of women, began chafing Rostov, saying that he was more wily than any of them, and that it would not be a bad thing if he introduced to them the pretty Polish girl he had saved. Rostov took the joke as an insult, flared up, and said such unpleasant things to the officer that it was all Denisov could do to prevent a duel. When the officer had gone away, Denisov, who did not himself know what Rostov's relations with the Polish girl might be, began to upbraid him for his quickness of temper, and Rostov replied, "Say what you like. She is like a sister to me, and I can't tell you how it offended me because, well, for that reason." Denisov patted him on the shoulder and began rapidly pacing the room without looking at Rostov, as was his way at moments of deep feeling. "Ah, what a mad breed you Wostovs are," he muttered, and Rostov noticed tears in his eyes. All right, there we go, another chapter down. Chapter 99, no less. And we're back hanging out with Rostov again, young Nikolai Rostov. It's always a bit slow, a chapter, when it jumps to another setting. I was really enjoying those last few chapters with Pierre and Prince Andrei. And this seems to happen every time with this book where it jumps to a new setting. The first chapter or two is a bit slow. This one had some good moments, though. I liked that at the end, you know, Nikolai was kind enough to take in this father and daughter and infant and you know, nurse them back to health, so to speak. And then he was also so protective of them that he almost got into a duel defending the honour of the young lady. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Young Nikolai, you know, he's naive and young and a bit stupid, but I think he's a good person. Same with Denisov too. Not so naive and stupid, but I also think he's a good person. Turtle Vader pointed out, "Rostov plans to pay his parents back by saving 80% of the allowance that they provide him. Do you think he will succeed? And does it right his wrong to pay back his parents using money that they gave him?" De Fleury responded, "Wait, the 10,000 Rostov receives isn't his army pay. It's his care package from Daddy. Well, that's good that Rostov is embarrassed to take it all. I hope he manages to budget and make it happen. That would take effort and indicate real change, and a new ability to resist temptation. I can't help comparing Rostov to a charming, foolish young person that I know, whose sorry would be emotionally real, but who'd never manage to control himself once the moment of remorse has passed." JMama8779 said, "I missed this. I assumed it was his army pay. You may be onto something, though. Of course, he's planning on changing his habits and repaying his parents, but he is pretty impulsive. It might get him into some trouble again." I actually didn't notice whilst reading it that it was that 10,000 was from his parents. It wasn't his salary, it was his pocket money. But hey, he's forward-thinking enough to set a 5-year plan in motion and pay back his old man, so that's pretty good. He hasn't swept it under the rug. So Brian E. Denton's Medium page about this chapter pointed out something that was stated in the chapter, that during the period covered by this chapter, only 2 members of the regiment are injured in action, but nearly half of them are lost to hunger and sickness. Turtle Vader asked the question, "The soldiers in Platov's regiment are dying at an alarming rate, but nobody seems to take much notice. How do you think they would fare against a French offensive against them? What if the French are no better off?" It's really weird the way Tolstoy deals with people dying in this book, isn't it? They just drop off like flies, and it's almost... there's no dreariness about it. Like, he's talking about how starving they are and there's no food for the horses and it's cold and wet and miserable. But Rostov seems pretty chipper. You know, he's setting his life in motion. He's saying it feels more like home than his actual home does. He's excited about the clear path forward for his life. You know, there's no chaos of should I do this, shouldn't I do that. All the difficult decisions of normal society, that's all taken away. And it's the rules are simple. And if you follow the rules and be a good soldier, you get rewarded. And he loves that, the simplicity of it. It's the institutionalization, I suppose. Or yeah, people crave that, to be part of a system that they know the rules of. Isn't it strange that people will choose a restrictive, systematic lifestyle where the control is taken away and you don't get to make decisions, you just have to follow the rules, and if you follow the rules, you're rewarded. And he says that feels more like home, and he welcomes that over all the freedom that he had back home when he was, you know, having the best time of his life, doing whatever he wanted, and he had that burden, so to speak, of what am I going to do with my day. In this chapter, he's saying how happy he is to not have to figure out what to do with all that freedom. What a strange quirk of humanity that is. It's also an interesting question about how would they fare if their enemies attacked them at the moment. They're also starved and destitute. They might not endure that, but by the same token, their enemy might be in a similar state. You can only really assume that they would be in a similar state. They're not far away. Well, then again, they might be holed up in somewhere better than this kind of dilapidated old German village. Maybe they're in a city with resources and food and whatnot. Must be frustrating for these Russians to have money and still be starving because there's nowhere to buy food. Anyway, I'm going to leave this episode here. Thank you very much for listening. I will see you tomorrow for our 100th episode.